Thank you very much, Geoffrey. As you know, I've long advocated tax reform, both in lowering the burden of taxation generally, but also in replacing inefficient taxes with efficient ones. Unfortunately, in the current political environment, the prospects for tax reform appear unfavourable. The Rudd Labor government does not seem to have further tax cuts anywhere on its agenda. After opposing the coalition's tax cuts in 2005 and copying 91.5% of the coalition's tax policy during the last election, the Prime Minister has now said there will be no additional cuts in tax, even if revenue comes in higher than expected. And yet in his speech in Perth on the 21st of January, he had the audacity to say, for over a decade, the past government did not put forward a strategic vision for the tax system. This from a man who, in speaking to the GST legislation on the 30th of June 99, said, when the history of this parliament, this nation and this century is written, 30th of June 1999 will be recorded as a day of fundamental injustice, an injustice which is real, an injustice which is not simply conjured up by the fleeting rhetoric of politicians. I interpolate by observing that he probably wishes his rhetoric had been more fleeting than it has turned out to be. It will be recorded, he went on to say, as the day when the social compact that has governed this nation for the last 100 years was torn up. Well, there could not be a more damning indictment, you would think. And that is what he had to say about our most significant tax reform in a generation. And yet, no man of principle is our new Prime Minister. In government, he now has the opportunity to repeal the GST and return the wholesale sales tax, financial institutions duty, debits tax, stamp duty on marketable securities, conveyancing duties on business, stamp duties on leases, stamp duties on mortgages, bonds, debentures, the bed tax, a very long list, which you're all very familiar with. And yet when challenged to do just that, Mr Rudd said, my basis for not touching the GST is it is there. It is now part of the taxation firmament of the country, and if you were to try and turn it on its head, I think you would just create extraordinary chaos for business. Well, when it comes to tax reform, Mr Rudd is not exactly a profile in courage. Does he think that introducing the GST was easy and that it did not involve turning anything on its head? The wholesale sales tax was introduced in the 1930s. It needed to be unscrambled despite being, in his own words, in the then taxation firmament of the country. Now, naturally, I disagree with Mr Rudd on the GST. But if he was a man of principle who really thought the GST was fundamentally unjust, he would abolish it and bring back the wholesale sales tax and other taxes, no matter how much short-term pain it might cause. You see, that is the point of reform. It takes guts. It can cause problems because invariably there are winners and losers, and it can be difficult, if not impossible, to compensate the losers, even if the benefits of reform will improve the lot of those who lose in the short term. But this, of course, is a Prime Minister who said that Western Australia should prepare for the end of the mining boom by investing in Latin American real estate. A Prime Minister who's mastered the art of symbolism but appears to have no new ideas except to hold a summit and indulge in many reviews. He lists George Orwell as one of his favourite authors and has certainly mastered Newspeak, but he seems to believe passionately in two mutually contradictory ideas. Firstly, that free markets are bad, but yet that he claims to be an economic conservative. And this is one of the most disappointing things about the recent history of tax reform in Australia. The vicious and opportunistic, unprincipled indeed, opposition by the Labor Party to the coalition's GST reforms stymied the opportunity for further significant tax reform. The political pain it caused ensured that the future reforms of the tax system, the tax cuts in 2003 and then every year through to 2007, were relatively modest compared to the landmark of the GST. Now, the coalition is passionate about tax reform. Labor has no interest in real economic reform. It lists various plans, essentially symbolic in nature, and with a timetable for implementation that are conveniently well outside that of the present parliament. In other words, they seek to be able to claim they're doing something when they're not. They'd like to go to the next election with a self-judged 3-year report card that is similar to Mr Rudd's recent Napoleonic first 100 days statement. I would like to say that progress is being made and to seek a vote again for Labor to continue progress in much the same way as Mr Yemmer did in the lead up to the last New South Wales election. Look at all the plans. 5-point plan to fight inflation, 10-point plan for federal-state relations, 5-point plan for small business, 6-point plan for simpler super, 5-point regional plan to combat avian influenza, among many others. A plethora of plans without an end in sight. Now today, I want to discuss just one of those plans. This is the 5-point plan to combat inflation. This was outlined in Mr Rudd's speech on the 21st of January, and he and Mr Swan and Mr Tanner, among others, have been repeating these lines ad nauseum. The 5 points are fiscal restraint, with a budget surplus target of at least 1.5% of GDP in 2008-2009, encouraging private savings, tackling the chronic skills shortages, providing national leadership to address infrastructure bottlenecks, and introducing measures to boost workforce participation. In and of themselves, all of these points seem unobjectionable. Who could oppose higher savings, ending shortages and removing bottlenecks? But they were not designed as a coherent plan to combat inflation. They're separate measures announced over a period and only latterly cobbled together as a 5-point plan that could be used as a soundbite whenever Mr Rudd or his ministers are asked difficult questions about economic policy in general and inflation in particular. The first point. The Rudd government seems to be confused about fiscal policy and government spending. Cutting wasteful government spending is, of course, a good idea in principle. But remember, not everybody agrees on what is wasteful, as we've seen in the last 24 hours. And remember that Labor invariably opposed prudent fiscal management and opposition. For example, it opposed the welfare-to-work policies, which were crucial to bringing people into the labour force from the Disability Support Program, and therefore reducing social security expenditure while increasing tax receipts. We've heard a lot about razor gangs, but talk is cheap. The last time Labor was in government, spending increased by an average of 3.3% per year in real terms, compared to only 1.3% under the coalition. In the last full year of the Howard government, Australian government expenditure grew by 0.6% in real terms. And if the current fiscal situation was so poor, why did Labor not deliver a mini-budget in its first 100 days? There was no mini-budget because there was no fiscal surprise or $10 billion Beazley black hole, the Coalition Charter of Budget Honesty, a coalition initiative, our initiative, Howard Government initiative, ensured that budget forecasts and projections were transparent. When Labor took office, it had more than half of the 2007-2008 fiscal year to slow government spending, but chose not to exercise this option through a mini-budget. During the election campaign, Labor said that the reckless spending must stop and claimed that its spending commitments would be less than the coalition's. But this too is a myth. The election spending commitments of both parties, even including Labor's so-called budgetary savings, were roughly the same. And let us not forget that Labor began making spending promises as soon as Mr Rudd took over the Labor leadership, well before the election campaign. And many of Mr Rudd's promises have very steep cost ramp-ups outside of the forward estimates, and so are disguised, for example, his commitment to increase foreign aid expenditure to 0.5% of gross national income. Mr Swan is very fond of saying that the RBA issued 20 warnings to the Howard government, but not a single one of these so-called warnings mention a poor fiscal situation as a cause of current inflationary pressures. On the contrary, the Reserve Bank and international organisations have consistently praised the coalition government for its exemplary macroeconomic management, as the IMF said in September last year. The praise is well deserved. The coalition only loosened fiscal policy in 2 out of its 11 budgets. Over the last 5 years, the surplus has never declined as a percentage of GDP. The coalition paid off Labor's $96 billion in debt, and as a result, the Australian taxpayer is now saving around $9 billion in debt interest each year. During the last 3 full years, the coalition government's actual budget surpluses were 1.5%, 1.6% and 1.6% of GDP. So depending on the final outcome for 07-08, which will not be known until October or November, Labor's target of a surplus of 1.5% of GDP in 2008-2009 could actually represent a modest loosening of fiscal policy, not a tightening. Because our economy is growing so strongly, I suspect the actual surplus in 2007-2008 will be around 2% of GDP. That would represent a tightening of fiscal policy of 0.4 percentage points of GDP over 2006-2007. So to tighten in the next year, Labor's 2008-2009 target will have to be well above 2% of GDP. And this brings me to the question of whether Labor will be able to match the Coalition's first two budgets. I doubt it. In the 96-97 and 97-98 budgets, the Coalition tightened fiscal policy by 0.9 and 1.2% percentage points of GDP, respectively, for an overall tightening of 2.1% of GDP. That is, to match the Coalition's fiscal policy rectitude when it first took office, Labor would need to deliver, not forecast, a surplus of 3.7% of GDP in its second budget. The second point is encouraging private saving. Labor announced on the 4th of November 2007 a first home savers account scheme that is supposed to help homeowners enter the housing market. The measure, which focuses entirely on the demand side, is also supposed to put downward pressure on inflation, or so it's said. Now, housing affordability is certainly a very important issue, and those of you that have followed it for some years will remember I've had a deep interest in it from back when I was chairman of the Menzies Research Centre, and we published a very comprehensive study on the issue. But let's fast forward to today. What do the experts say about it? The Reserve Bank Governor, Ian Macfarlane, has addressed it on many occasions, but probably the most pithy explanation was when he said in his testimony to the House of Representatives Committee, why has the price of an entry-level new home gone up as much as it has? Why was it not like it was in 1951 when my parents moved to East Bentley, which was the fringe of Melbourne at that stage, and were able to buy a block of land very cheaply and put a house up on it very cheaply? Why is that not available? I think it's pretty apparent now that the reluctance to release new land, plus the new approach whereby the purchaser has to pay for all the services up front, sewerage, roads, footpaths and all that sort of stuff, has enormously increased the price of the new entry-level home. That is a supply-side issue, not a demand-side issue. And Glenn Stevens made exactly the same point in his testimony in August last year. Now, given that the RBA seems to regard the supply side as the key issue in housing affordability, is it any wonder that none of Mr Swan's 20 RBA warnings mentioned first home savers accounts as a solution to current inflationary pressures? Without addressing the critical issues on the supply side of the housing market, any attempts to increase the demand for housing through subsidies will not drive down housing prices. Indeed, they could fuel further house rises in the absence of increased supply. That is why the Coalition's election policy was a more comprehensive package that addressed both demand and supply side issues. Labor's subsidy would not be enough to even pay for stamp duty on many new homes, which are at record highs, due principally to the refusal of state governments and councils to do more on stamp duty or land release policies, Now, whatever other merits the policy may have, it is a bizarre proposal to fight inflation. And what of the net effect on national savings? What we are doing is encouraging private savings with government subsidies, hence by less government saving. I've yet to see any Treasury modelling that shows that the net effect would be an increase in overall saving. The third point was the chronic skills crisis. Labor has said there is a chronic, and I emphasise the word chronic, skills crisis. If that is true, we should be observing wage pressures right across the economy, in all states and territories and all sectors. But that is simply not happening. The Reserve Bank has consistently said that economy-wide labour costs have been contained, and they've attributed it to flexible labour markets repeatedly. In the recently released national accounts, average non-farm compensation per employee increased by a modest 0.1% to be 4.6% higher through the year. That was the lowest quarterly growth of this series in 5 years. So not surprisingly, none of Mr Swan's 20 RBA warnings mention a chronic skills crisis as a cause of current inflationary pressures. The truth is that Australia does not have a chronic skills crisis, which would have caused excessive real wage growth right across the economy. I do not deny that skills shortages are an issue, and an important one. Just last week we saw reports of mining companies recruiting submariners, giving rise to shortages in crews for the Collins-class submarine. An economy with 4.1% unemployment will of course experience higher demand for skilled workers in particular sectors. But who said that economic growth should always be uniform across all sectors and regions? Product markets don't have a habit of behaving uniformly. It'd be very dull if they did. But that's why it's so important to have flexible labour markets and lower taxes, to give individuals the freedom to move jobs when they need to and the incentive to invest in their own human capital when the market tells them they'll be rewarded for doing so. That's why the Coalition liberalised Australia's immigration policy, allowing record numbers of skilled immigrants, and provided a Section 457 visa to further encourage migration to Australia of skilled labour. The Labor Party opposed many of those measures. The welfare-to-work policy was also vital for increasing the number of people entering the labour market, thereby reducing pressure in areas where there are, in fact, skills shortages. The Coalition also created the Australian Technical Colleges and dramatically increased the number of apprenticeships. University funding was also increased significantly, with the 2003 $11 billion injection into the sector and $1.9 billion in the 07-08 budget to assist in the areas of skills shortage, as well as the $6 billion Higher Education Endowment Fund. There are now 63% more students undertaking higher education than in 1996. The Rudd government's policy proposals in this area are simply tinkering at the margins. The fourth point was infrastructure bottlenecks. Infrastructure is another one of those words that's been hijacked by Labor. Upon hearing the word infrastructure, how many of us immediately think of government spending and taxpayer-funded public works? But the truth is that there has been a huge movement towards private provision of infrastructure in Australia during the last decade. Australia's infrastructure and capital stock do not only consist of roads and rail that are usually associated with government, it also includes additional factories and equipment and machinery that have purely private uses, but then nonetheless provide benefits to consumers by lowering unit costs and consumer prices and improving quality. As the Reserve Bank has repeatedly emphasised, and most particularly and graphically in the latest statement on monetary policy, private investment has been booming, building capacity for future productivity growth, adding to the supply side of the economy. In the statement of monetary policy, the RBA noted the high profitability and low borrowing costs had been the key drivers of the boom in real business investment, which has grown by an average of 13% per year over the last 5 years. In the most recent December 07 national accounts, new private business investment grew by 0.6% in the December quarter to be 11% higher through the year. Notably, strong growth was seen in new machinery and equipment, growing 3.9% in the December quarter. Now, government-provided infrastructure is largely a state responsibility, and if deficiencies in infrastructure exist, it is in large measure because of poor planning by Labor state governments rather than the lack of spending by the federal government. Let me give you just one example. Only last week, the ACCC said the New South Wales government's open access policy at Port Waratah coal terminal in Newcastle is prolonging bottlenecks by removing incentives for investment. Here's another. Over the last 3 years, the New South Wales government has ripped out of Sydney Water as tax and dividends 91% of the entire profit before tax. Just think about that. Think about a company, private company, that had substantial capital expenditure requirements looming, running a dividend policy like that. It is inconceivable. It could only happen in a government-owned enterprise, which is not facing competition. Now, making those points is not playing the blame game. It's simply telling the truth and holding those responsible to account. When it comes to infrastructure, getting efficient rationing through sensible pricing structures, developing appropriate property rights arrangements, and putting in place rational regulatory regimes can often create far more economic value and reduce inefficiencies than simply spending more taxpayer dollars. The key focus of infrastructure policy should be efficiency and net benefits at the individual project level, not aggregate spending targeted at reducing the economy-wide rate of inflation. So again, it's hardly surprising that not one of Mr. Swan's 20 RBA warnings mentions infrastructure bottlenecks as a cause of current inflationary pressures. Bottlenecks have more to do with congestion in particular regions and productivity in particular sectors, particularly exports, as I've noted. They have little to do with inflation, which is the phenomenon of continuous economy-wide price pressures. infrastructure is a key microeconomic reform issue. It is not a lever that macroeconomic policymakers can pull whenever they think the economy needs a bit of short-term fine-tuning. Using inflationary pressures to justify more spending without focusing on the net benefits of individual projects runs the risk of producing a herd of white elephants. A more fundamental point, and one that the new government has not even mentioned, is that government spending always draws resources away from the private sector. Even if our economy was not experiencing full employment, increasing government spending on infrastructure always risks driving up the prices of inputs and materials that are used for infrastructure projects and could fuel inflationary pressures of their own. There is no free lunch. The extent of our mining boom has caught most people by surprise. Certainly our large mining companies, BHP and Rio, did not expect such a sustained boom, which partly accounts for a need for them to catch up in infrastructure and other investment spending. But they are likely to have a better idea of where, when and what to invest than the government does. The fifth point is labour force participation. Now, Mr. Swan's 20 warnings do not mention labour force participation as a cause of inflationary pressures, for a very good reason. Participation reached a record high of 65.3% in November 2007 and is currently only slightly lower at 65.2%. A recent study by the Productivity Commission, by the staff of the Productivity Commission, ranks Australia fifth highest in the OECD in labour market participation. Female participation has grown markedly under the coalition government, and our labour market reforms drew people to the labour force through more flexible workplace arrangements and higher wages. And what does the Rudd government propose in this area to increase participation? Tax cuts, copied from the coalition, and an increase in the childcare tax rebate to 50%. Labor's proposal to increase the childcare tax rebate from 30 to 50% was announced in October 2007. It's an extension of the Howard government's program, which increased childcare funding by 113% in real terms from 96 and 07, and introduced the childcare benefit and the childcare tax rebate. Again, more tinkering at the margins and very little to do with inflation. Ladies and gentlemen, it should be clear now the new government does not have any new ideas in terms of economic reform and even fewer with dealing with inflation. It has no tax policy. It proposed a number of policies over the campaign, different measures for diverse reasons, and packages them together to present what it seeks to market as a coherent plan to tackle inflation, which it has latterly identified as public enemy number one. Yet most of these policies are tinkering at the margins. None are revolutionary. None take pressure off inflation in the short term when it is most needed, and all involve government taking the action. It shows the lack of faith that Mr. Rudd and Mr. Swan have in the private sector, for it is the private sector that generates our wealth, that provides our jobs, and that best allocates our scarce resources to their most efficient use. The Australian economy is strong today because the previous government knew when to intervene in the market and when not to intervene. Its philosophy was proudly private sector focused. Labor, by contrast, presents a fabric of multiple reviews and expanding the role of government through national leadership. It is mixing its messages, claims to have a deregulation agenda, but wants to re-regulate the labor market. It claims to support tax cuts, but proposes to squirrel away future taxpayers' money. Claims to be focused on fighting inflation, but puts forward proposals that do little to reduce inflationary pressures, while using reckless rhetoric on inflation to score political points, talking up the problem and fuelling inflationary expectations. Labor's talked a lot about governments investing in the productive side of our economy, but every dollar spent by government has to be raised through taxation, and taxes have efficiency costs of their own. At the margin, the real issue is what is done with the last dollar of revenue that is raised. Should it be spent by the government, or should taxes be reduced and the money instead be retained by the private sector? In other words, cutting taxes is just as much an investment in the efficiency of our economy as government spending could be, but isn't always. Let's hope that the environment for serious tax reform does not continue to be blighted. We do need a new era of tax reform, and I look forward to the contribution of this conference towards it. Thank you very much.